Radio Netherlands presents Where the Tiger Roamed. The program is produced and presented by Dira Sujan.
For centuries, or for thousands of years, the tiger was always regarded by man as the most powerful creature on land. So in mythology and belief, it was linked to the goddess Durga, and it became her vehicle. So when she was riding the tiger and going across the Indian countryside, she had the power with the tiger to bring light on planet Earth, to defeat evil, to defeat darkness, and to kill all the demons that were around. And what's interesting is that this symbol didn't happen just in India. The Taoist Pope in China is also shown endlessly riding the tiger in his search for the elixir of life. So there's something about the tiger which was about fertility, regeneration, and reproduction. And the myth and the beliefs travel with forest communities all across the range of the tiger. There are great links in them, even though people are different, languages are different. But somewhere, the tiger linked human beings in terms of how they believed in a concept which was about the creation of life.
At the turn of the century, the tiger was king of the Asian jungles. Nearly 100,000 of them roamed the continent from Siberia to Borneo, and more than half that number were to be found in India. Throughout history, there have been cultures that have worshipped the tiger for its beauty and its strength. But ironically, it's for these very qualities that the tiger is presently in crisis. In the last 100 years, man managed to accomplish what nature hadn't in more than a dozen centuries: bring the tiger perilously close to extinction. Tiger skins have long been prized as trophies, and many collections to be found in the former palaces of Maharajas show sepia photographs of shooting parties proudly standing over the carcasses of the tigers bagged in the day's shoot. Fateh Singh Rathore is currently known for his vociferous role in tiger conservation in India. However, like many zealots, he's a convert. In his younger days, he used to be in the service of the Maharaja of Jaipur, who had 5 shooting reserves. It was his job to arrange the hunt for the guests of the Maharaja, who used to come to shoot tiger.
We had to arrange live baits. I mean, you have to tie the buffalo with the bell, which is hanging and making the noise. So the tiger has to be attracted and ultimately come in the night and finish it off. And tiger has a habit, once they get the food, it doesn't go very long distance. So we have to have the food and water next to it so that they can just remain for days. So they're quite familiar to situation before the royalty or Maharaja or somebody is coming to hunt these animals. They used to show their power to people. Even the Maharaja and Raja used to shoot because show them power that they can still shoot the most powerful animal in the wild, and they are still very strong.
A tiger shoot in those days was no simple affair. The hunting party consisted of teams of beaters and trackers. Workmen would construct 20-foot-high platforms called machans, and seated safely on these, the king and his guests could pick off the frightened, cornered beasts. Between 1860 and 1960, 20,000 tigers were shot in India by colonial and local rulers. However, when the Rajas were in power, the jungles were their domain, reserved for their private pleasure, and they shouldered the responsibility for maintaining them, employing gamekeepers and forestry guards. All that changed when India gained its independence from the British in 1947, and the Maharajas lost most of their ancestral rights.
Between 47 and 58, I think there was no protector as far as wildlife or forests are concerned, because it was completely a mess. And earlier it was definitely a privilege of the Rajas and Maharajas to protect the forest plus protect the wild animals for their shoot, so that people, they are always fear of the Maharajas. But 47, independence came, it was completely a independence to the poachers and hunters. The national parks become orphaned because nobody was there to take care.
By 1970, 95% of the world's tigers were wiped out. Out of 8 subspecies, 1 had already become extinct and 2 more were on the verge of it. And India, which had previously been home to the majority of the world's tiger population, only had 1,800 left. A worldwide alarm on behalf of the tiger sparked off a movement in India to protect it. Under the auspices of Indira Gandhi, then Prime Minister, Project Tiger was launched in 1974. Hunting was banned and 23 special tiger reserves were established, including the area of Sawai Madhopur, the earlier hunting grounds of the Maharaja of Jaipur, which became the Ranthambore National Park. However, there were people living on that land who for generations had used the resources the forest offered them, collecting firewood and water, herbs and sometimes a bit of meat freely. When Ranthambore was declared a park, these people were relocated out of the park's boundaries and forbidden to enter the land they had grown up on. Jaganlal Gujjar is the head man of Kailashpuri, one of the villages that was relocated.
एक तो हमसे कहा कि भाई आपके पास जितनी जमीन है उसे हम आपको 5 बीघा एक्स्ट्रा जमीन दे देंगे.
Most of us had little land, but there was always a danger of attack from tigers and leopards. The government gave us this new land where we're living now and promised to give us electricity, schools, wells and a hospital if we left our land in Ranthambore. So we moved and now we're closer to the road. In one way it's better because we're not as isolated as we were and we now have a school. But so far no electricity and no hospital. The government said that once we settled down, they would give us what they promised. And we've been here for some years now, but still they haven't done it.
For a while in the 70s and early 80s, it looked like the government's efforts in tiger conservation was working. The 1993 census showed that India's tiger numbers had come up to more than 3,700, nearly double what they'd been in 1970. But conservationists hardly got a chance to breathe a sigh of relief. The tiger was facing threats from several directions. 1% of the total landmass of India is reserved for national parks. A further 3% has been set aside for sanctuaries. This is land that in theory is inviolate, but which in actual fact is not. Corruption has been responsible for mining leases and tree felling in protected land. Local officials can be bribed to look the other way when industries are set up too close to national forests or when they're not being too careful about toxic runoffs in the waters that go into sanctuaries. And the turn of Indian politics in the last decade has also contributed to the downfall of the tiger. Writer and environmental activist Valmik Thapar has worked in the field of tiger conservation for more than 20 years.
Till the mid-80s you had one federal government which had 80% of the state governments with it. That means the Congress Party ruled pretty much most of the time the centre, and it had nearly 14 state governments where tigers existed, which were also Congress. So the word of the Prime Minister, the then Indira Gandhi, followed by Rajiv Gandhi, mattered. They were both interested in wildlife, so the chief ministers of the states followed their advice. Today, we have a scenario where there are 11 political parties in different tiger states. The entire political context has changed. So the federal government only has 2 states in India where it rules. The rest, it has to hope that its advice is followed, and most of the time it is not, because saving the tiger is not a priority of these political parties. So this has changed completely from the mid-80s to the end of the 90s. The complexion of politics has changed. That directly affects the tiger.
Ranthambore sprawls over 1,300 square kilometres of temperate forests in the northern state of Rajasthan, and the heart of it is dominated by the ramparts and towers of a 1,000-year-old fort. 7 kilometres of walls line the rocky hills of the park, and a number of beautiful Rajput hunting lookouts provide a dramatic backdrop to the forests and plains where birds, deer and crocodile can be seen in abundance. I went to visit Ranthambore with Nithin Pandya in the hope of spotting a tiger in the wild. A few years ago, that would have been guaranteed because Ranthambore was famous for its dense tiger population. Nowadays, it's a rare phenomenon because the 15 to 20 tigers left in the park have become understandably wary of intruders.
Do you see the grass over there? Huh? And the two date trees just below it. If you come and stand over here, you can make out. It's twitching the tail. Can you see it? It's only when it makes a movement you can find out, because the color of the tigers that it merges with the background. Careful, look. There. Got it. Look, she's turning over. Can you see the bloated stomach? She's pregnant.
I can just see her when she moves.
There. That's the alarm call of the babblers. They've sighted her.
We spotted this pregnant female after a long day in a jeep with two experienced trackers following every pugmarked trail. The locals of Sawai Madhopur remember a time when tigers were not nearly so difficult to find. It was common to see a tiger ambling across a road or napping on the ramparts of the fort. 5 years ago, there were about 45 tigers in Ranthambore. That number has since been halved by poachers.
The illegal wildlife trade has become a huge monster. It's probably second to the narcotics trade in this country. So we need to rethink completely on how we deal with those who violate nature. A country which was trying to protect its wildlife and was doing quite well in the mid-80s suddenly faces the worst ever crisis, where we could have something like somewhere between 2,000 to 3,000 tigers left in India. We are losing a couple of hundred definitely every year, if not more. So you require political will and leadership to change the way you administer wildlife, to change the way you administer tiger-related issues.
Of all the powerful carnivores, tiger has acquired mythological properties of strength, courage, nobility, and human being has been afraid of it. It has worshipped it, admired it, and these are the properties the human race wants it in oneself, and therefore you feel that every part of this tiger in some way can be beneficial.
Ashok Kumar is Vice President of the Wildlife Protection Society of India. It's one of the main watchdog organizations that's trying to curb the alarming growth of illegal poaching. Tiger skins have been traded from India to the West since Roman times, and when the tiger became a protected animal, the trade routes didn't disappear. They just turned into smuggling routes.
The pressures of poaching originally come from Southeast Asian countries because of a demand on the tiger's bones, on pretty much every part of the tiger's, from his testes, his penis, his claws, his whiskers, his eyes, his flesh. They all seem to have some medicinal cure, aphrodisiac properties. So a lot of Indian tigers have ended up in the last decade into the stomach of lots of human beings who believe that parts of the tiger have magical cures.
Although every part of the tiger is used for some sort of medicine, from the eyes, which are said to calm convulsions, to the whiskers, used against toothache, it's for its aphrodisiac properties that tiger products are most renowned. A bowl of tiger penis soup goes for a cool $320 for the man of means who needs a bit of help stiffening his resolve. For the less extravagant, there are other alternatives.
Now, there is a thing called tiger bone wine. You dip tiger bones in brandy, I think, and you leave it for a while, and then you drink that brandy, and it's supposed to acquire some of the tiger strength, will get passed on to you. Virtually every part of the tiger in some use or the other. The tiger claws are used as charms. They're made into necklaces or amulets. They're supposed to ward off evil. Whiskers have uses. I mean, the bile is used for something else and tail is used for something else. Perhaps more important than skins is the tiger bone trade. In fact, that is the trade which is today the biggest threat to the tiger. Bones are smuggled from India to Tibet. From Tibet, they go to Far Eastern countries, they go to China. Even though China has a very good ban on tiger bone trade in place, but it's a vast country. So therefore, there is a clandestine trade in China, also in Korea, Taiwan, Far Eastern countries. These medicines are made there. They're also smuggled to West, because they're overseas oriental community in many of the countries, in major European countries, in Australia, Canada, United States, UK, and tiger bone medication is smuggled, and therefore, right now it may well be true that, in fact, the usage may be very high because the overseas Chinese are also wealthy. And even though their official policy may be to ban the tiger bone trade, they are not good enough domestic laws. In Japan, the tiger bone trade is still legal.
What kind of price do they fetch in the market?
Now, the current price will be about $200 a kilo. And therefore, a tiger poacher may well make more money out of tiger bones from one tiger than from the skin.
The Institute of Indigenous Medicine in Bhutan is one of the many medical centres around the world that use tiger bones for traditional remedies. The Institute's Dr. Wong Chuk explained how the bones are processed to make medicines for diseases like epilepsy, rheumatism, and arthritis.
What you're seeing here is the skull of a tiger. We use tiger bones to make medicine to cure diseases like rheumatism and epilepsy. We prepare the medicine by putting the bones in an earthen pot. Then we bury the pot in the ground and make a big fire on top of it and leave it there until the bones are burnt. Then we take the pot out, and inside the pot there's a lot of ash from the burnt bones. From this ash, we make pills for our medicine.
The Bhutanese Institute of Indigenous Medicine maintains it doesn't use products obtained illegally through poaching. It claims to have access to a private stock of tiger bones kept by the king. Even if that claim is true, stocks would be limited, and one has to wonder what happens to places like this institute if an essential ingredient can only be obtained illegally. China, Korea, Taiwan, and other parts of Southeast Asia have banned trade in tiger products, but it's flourishing nonetheless. Between 1990 and 1992, China exported 27 million units of tiger-based products to countries around the world. Since tigers are all but extinct in China, it's assumed that the bulk of the tiger products processed and consumed there are smuggled in from India. A daily user of tiger bone medicine uses 1 to 2 kilos of bones a year. Today, with less than 6,000 tigers left in the wild, its extinction seems imminent. And even reserves like Ranthambore, which are overseen by the government's forestry department as well as a brace of NGOs, are not safe from the reach of the poachers. Ashok Kumar.
Ranthambore was hit by a secret, unknown poaching wave in roughly, our estimate is, end of 91 or middle of 92. Ranthambore used to have 40 or 50 tigers, 50 plus is probably was the highest they had reached. Tiger visibility was good, tiger was doing well there, and suddenly this bone trade hit India. What happened was, China had a stockpile of tigers. At some point in history, 10 or 15 years ago, they had eliminated tiger from large parts of their own country because they thought it was some kind of a pest, agricultural pest, and those bones had piled up. When they used up those bones, and they started looking around where the tigers were, the largest number of tigers at roughly at 1990 was in India. At 1989 census, India had 4,300 and odd tigers. So obviously, if a thief has to rob a bank, he obviously wants to go to the bank which has the largest amount of money or which is easier to get to. So they targeted India. Ranthambore was hit by such a poaching wave. At first, we did not believe it because in India, we did not know that tiger bones are substantially in trade. We did a study. We did an undercover study. And it was in the month of August 1993 that the biggest seizure of tiger bones in world history took place right here in Delhi. Over 2 days, 400 kilos of tiger bones were caught, 8 tiger skins, and this is still the largest seizure in the world history. And the entire extent of the tiger bone trade for the first time was revealed. If you go back 20 years ago, bones were thrown away in India. In the days of the shikar, in the hunting days in India, no one had any value for bones. The pit was dug and they were just buried. But now what happens, we are coming across cases where skin is destroyed because skin is much more difficult to smuggle. You're liable to get caught more easily, whereas bones can be concealed easier. And people have specifically targeted bones and left the skin behind or destroyed the skin.
The obvious question in this case would be, why not breed tigers specifically for the purpose of feeding this seemingly unstoppable industry? The idea of tiger farms may seem abhorrent to people who are in love with the romantic myth of the great cat in the wild, but even if that distaste could be overcome, tiger farms are not the solution.
In this trade, they want tiger bones, and the real demand is for bones of wild tiger. Because human race has seen certain qualities in a tiger of strength, nobility, courage, whatever. And therefore, the bones, the real bones required for this trade are from wild tiger. Otherwise, it would have been very simple. Tigers are exceedingly easy to breed in captivity. In zoos, for instance, there is a problem. There are too many tigers in zoos all over the world. No zoo wants a fresh tiger. Tigers are very difficult to breed in the wild. The mortality rate is high, and that's the way it should be, in fact. That's what makes tiger a tiger.
As the number of wild tigers diminishes, the prices they fetch climb and the incentives to poachers increase. One tiger can bring $6,000 to the higher level traders, though the poachers themselves don't earn nearly that much. The rings are run by traders in the cities who hire locals to do the actual killing.
The most pernicious are professional hunting tribes. The Kanjas, the Mogias, who are traditional hunters. They're very skilled. They'll walk into the jungle for 3 days, they can live off the ground. They do not need a vehicle, they do not require a house, they can sleep under a tree, they can eat and drink off the jungle. When they find a tiger, they will set a trap, they use leg traps, they'll poison, they will use arrows, they don't use guns. Guns make noises. This is the most difficult type of person, and they are the people who have traditionally always applied to the trade. People like this find it very easy to get into areas, normal forest areas, which are not tiger reserves. He could well be mistaken for a honey collector or a wood gatherer. I mean, it's very difficult to say that quietly, like he's in his pocket, he's got $1 worth of poison, which is enough to kill one, perhaps two tigers. He just goes in summer, when the water is restricted, there are pools where the tigers must come to drink. They can poison the pool, or they can find a natural kill by a tiger, or a cattle killed by the tiger, and smear this poison on it, and the tiger dies a horrifying, very excruciating death.
Fateh Singh Rathore, who's lived amongst the locals of Ranthambore, is a fierce protector of the tigers, but he understands the difficult situation the poachers are in and advocates another method to attack the problem.
We have to go to the root cause. Now, if the Mogias, you go to the Mogias, they are absolutely clothless, homeless, educationless, and their houses are nothing but a small hutment. They are living the same life which their grandfathers used to live 100 years before. So they learn only in the life is to kill the animal for food. Now, they have become now the informers, plus they are the suppliers in between the mafias who are buying the skin from these people. So now you have to look after these people.
Tiger ki poaching yahan par jab bhi hoti hai to jaise gaon wale to
the tigers are killed by tribes like the Mogias. Agents come and give them money for it. It's easy to convert them to this action because they can earn up to 5,000 to 10,000 rupees from it. That's more money than they would earn in a year. They don't have any other form of income, and they don't know how to do anything else except hunt. So they can kill the tiger, butcher it, and the agents come to collect the skin and the bones. Then they send it on through Tibet and then China.
Usha Kiran works with the Ranthambore Foundation, one of the non-governmental organizations set up to protect the park's tigers. She's a local from the area, and like many of the villagers, is not happy with the way the forestry department is managing its affairs there.
We've had bad experiences with the forestry department in the past. The villagers live near the forest, so they know when there's poaching going on. They go to report it to the forestry officials, but it's usually at 2 or 3 in the morning. And the officials always make some excuse that the driver isn't there or they can't go at that time, and so they don't even go to check the reports till about 7 or 8 in the morning, and then by then, the poachers have moved out. So because the forestry department always seems to be dragging its heels, the villagers lose interest. Also, sometimes they get in trouble themselves. Maybe they've gone into the forest to collect a little firewood, and it's not allowed. So if they report that there are poachers in the forests, the officials ask them, "How do you know? You're not supposed to be there yourselves." So things like this make the relations bad between the locals and the forest department.
The relations with the people around the tiger reserve is not cordial because there are clashes in the interest. The villagers want to come and collect the fuel wood, want to graze their cattle, and we oppose those activity. As a national park, you can't graze the animals, so you can't cut the forest. So that's the basic problem.
S.S. Chaudhary is the director of the Ranthambore National Park. He feels his forestry guards are in a vulnerable position. They live amongst the villagers they're supposed to police, but they have very little clout to back them up should a conflict arise between the two parties. On top of that, they're underpaid and ill-equipped to patrol the vast perimeters of the park.
There are certain incidents that our forest guards are beaten by the local people. You know, the foresters and forest guards are living in the remote areas. They do not have the powers to enforce the the Indian Penal Code. The guard is the lowermost functionary of the Forest Department. He's earning 2,500 to 3,000 rupees per month.
Okay, that's about 80 to 100 American dollars a month.
Yeah.
We don't have forest staff and forest networks which are enforcing the law and have the equipment, the machinery, the movement, let's say jeeps, trucks, motorcycles, these don't exist. They are forest guards who look after the tiger and the natural heritage, who don't have a pair of shoes. They are people who don't have jackets and uniforms. We have forest guards in India who are supposed to look after 10 to 15 square kilometers of forest area. And if you give them the right inputs and strengthen them, they have the possibility to create incredible deterrence for any poacher to come in. So far, we've ignored the forest guard.
Money comes in from all over the world for Project Tiger, but there's often infighting between the NGOs and the government forces, and between the NGOs themselves. But despite these setbacks, poachers are being apprehended. The Wildlife Protection Society is working valiantly to stem the flow of tiger poaching. It sends undercover agents to find the people who are masterminding shipments of wildlife products. They try to catch traders and poachers and punish them according to the law.
There are seizures. Tiger skins have been caught on the way to USA. They do go to Europe. They're very popular in the Middle East. The Arab sheikhs want to have them in their homes.
So when they're caught, what happens to them then?
Well, each country's laws are different. For instance, in India, if you have an old trophy which belonged to your father or grandfather and it was legally acquired when it was legal to hunt tigers, fine. You have an ownership certificate. But if you don't have it, the law is very tough in India. The law is quite good. The punishments are substantial. But unfortunately, what we have seen is also that the Indian legal process is exceedingly slow. A trial can take anything up to 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. I'm aware of a case which took something like 15 years. And therefore, because of this convoluted court process, very few people are actually going to jail.
Smugglers who are caught with contraband wildlife products are let out on bail with their case pending for years. And there's little doubt in the mind of watchdog bodies like the Wildlife Protection Society that as soon as these men are free, they return to their poaching activities. The people of Sawai Madhopur have lived side by side with the tiger for centuries. They're proud that their region is known as the land of the tiger. But they fear that soon the tiger will become nothing more than a symbol of what their land had once been.
We don't want to see the tiger disappear from here. We revere the tiger. We worship him like a god. And when we see him, we bow down to the ground. We know they're being killed, but we don't like it. But what can we do?
When we talk to older people, they tell us about the days before independence, when there were lots of tigers. They say that they would climb onto a machan that the Raja had built for his hunting and just sit there while their cattle grazed. And they looked forward to seeing a tiger roaming down below them. They would call to him and talk to him. That's what the old people remember. Now we hardly see a tiger in 3 or 4 months. When our children are grown up, they will never see tigers anymore at all. We villagers know that a tiger is disappearing from here and we don't want it to happen. But we don't know what to do about it, because it's being controlled by big people in Delhi. By the time our children are grown, there won't be any tigers left, only photographs. It's an awful situation.
If you look to the Rajasthan situation, look back 40, 50 years, there used to be tigers everywhere. This whole area was full of tigers. But now, all these animals has been almost cleared from everywhere except there are two pockets are left at the moment, is Ranthambore and Sariska. Even then, today's situation, whether it's 9 or 10 or 11 or 15 tigers are left in Ranthambore, and still if they can have the protection, the tigers still can survive, because the tiger has the lust for survival. If you look to the tiger, started his journey from Siberia, Amur, to Manchuria, to China, to India, to Taiwan, to all the way Java, Sumatra, and Borneo. And it has traveled
from where the zero temperature, they have started their journey, and they have ended their journey with a 47 centigrade in Rajasthan, and they still are surviving. So they have the great lust to survive.
You've been listening to Where the Tiger Roamed. The program was produced and presented by Dira Sujan. Technical assistance was provided by Frank Meyer. Additional research by Nithin Pandya. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.